This class tonight actually is being sponsored by someone who insisted on being anonymous, but he wanted to thank Dr. Shapiro for his 53-week series on his recent book. He said he only discovered Torah in Motion in the summer. He didn't know about us. And he started, he discovered Mark's classes and he listened. He finally listened to all 53. So he wanted to thank him and to thank us and Torah in Motion. So I do want to at least acknowledge that, even if it's anonymously. Okay, 8:31, Bakasha.
I also thank the sponsor, who I don't know. He's anonymous to me as well, but thank you very much. A couple things before we start, not that much. I got the answer. Just happened to, we spoke about KI, Keyleth Israel. I know we have a few people from Brookline area. Zev Aleph, again, he writes an article a few years ago called "The Origins of the Young Israel of Brookline and the Quest for Modern Orthodoxy." You can read all about how in 1925, Keyleth Israel had an important meeting to decide whether they would remain strictly Orthodox or modern Orthodox. And the vote was to be modern Orthodox, and that meant mixed seating. So because of that, that's Samuel Feuerstein and a few others broke away because they wanted to be strictly, they wanted to be strictly Orthodox. And that led to the creation of the Young Israel of Brookline. So you can check it out. Rabbi Ari Khan has been listening, and I thank him for sending me the following. We'll see in a little bit, I hope, Lieberman's involvement with the establishment, not just of Bar Ilan, but in particular the Machon Gavoa LaTorah, the Kollel, or the learning aspect of Bar Ilan. And this is named, if you go to the website, after the Jesselsons, who Lieberman was quite involved with and knew them and got them. The Justins were known in New York. They were on the board of YU and many other things, but also important for Bar Ilan. But what's not on the website, but if you go to Bar Ilan, which now we can go, finally Israel has changed their rules, you will see the following, which was put up by Jesselson, but for some reason it's on the website. So let me share with you now. So first of all, for the Midrashah, for the women, it's named after Beit Yehudit. Beit Yehudit is none other than Judith Lieberman. I'll even show you the plaque now, and Rabbi Ari Khan took a picture of this for me this week. Hold on, let me share now. Hold on. Oh, I have to share the picture again. Hold on a second here. So you'll see we saw that Rav Shabtai Rappaport is he teaches there, or he's head of it. So here's the plaque for in memory of Shlichah Rabbanit. This plaque looks very new. I don't know when it was put up. But as you see, it's in memory of Rabbanit Dr. Judith Lieberman. And then I'll show you finally the one. So we saw Judith Lieberman, and here is the plaque. He couldn't find a plaque for Shaul Lieberman. Well, let's see. Hold on a second. Yeah, see if I could pull it up here. Here it is. He couldn't find a description, but right at the door to the, it's called Beit Shaul. Machon Gavoa LaTorah. So, Hayeshiva Gavoa. So, here you go. Shaul Lieberman commemorated at Bar Ilan University. That's very nice. What else can I tell you? Oh, here's a book. Here it is. Chaim Be'er, Masadi Lugin. He's a writer in Israel, a popular writer. Let me hold on a second. There's this. She'll pull up your picture. I don't know today. He comes from a Dati background, and he knows all about Sfarim, very interested in it. Well, a couple of you have emailed me about a certain story, and lo and behold, it's in here, although it's inherited personally. But I don't think this is why it's famous, because this is only from 2019. The story appears as this book is all about his life in Sfarim. And the people he's known, very interesting, if you like that sort of stuff. So beginning on page 205, he tells the story that he met one of these, his friends from Jerusalem friends, among those who loves books. You know, you have this whole Jerusalem culture of books. And he asked me where I can get the book Shakian. We spoke about Shakian. We had classes on it of Lieberman. And we both spoke about how great Lieberman was. And then Chaim Be'er tells a story that he heard from Hillel Halkin. The story I told you that Lieberman davening for him was not, I mean, I know we tell everyone, you know, about davening. We spoke about this last couple semesters ago. I have to focus on and how so important it is. But well, Lieberman's attitude was like he saw it as something he just had to do to get on to learning. And he saw it as Bittul Torah. Although I did say that Hillel Halkin also said that Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur, he would be crying under the talus. But typical itfak. But then, oh, and his Jerusalem friend left when he said this and said, now he understands why, you know, the Hasidic movement had to arise because this downgrading of tefillah. But he says that as we're talking, someone's near with us and he tells us a story that shows you Lieberman's Yirat Shamayim. What's the story? That this guest came over to him. And in the version I've heard, it's actually Gershom Sholem. But I don't know. Gershom Sholem and Lieberman had times where they were very friendly and times not so friendly. Gershom Sholem supposedly was very offended when Lieberman introduced him as saying that there's that nonsense is nonsense, speaking about Kabbalah, but the history of nonsense is scholarship, because Sholem didn't want to think that his whole life was devoted to something that here Lieberman's thinking is nonsense. But once in introducing him another time, Lieberman says about Gershom Sholem, he says, there have been times when it's, you know, it's been Gimel Reishin, like we were separated, but now it's Sholem. Now we have peace. And if in the archives in Jerusalem, there's many, many letters of Lieberman and Sholem. But when the guest came into his house, Lieberman took his jacket and hung it up and did all that. But when he left, Lieberman didn't give him his jacket back. He didn't go greet to the bring him to the door or anything like that. The guest, he knew that he was speaking to some of Lieberman, everything has significance. So he asked him, why didn't you accompany me to the door and give me my jacket like you took it when I came in? So Lieberman replied to him. He says, I have a suspicion that your jacket has shotness. To take it off of you, that's a mitzvah, but to dress you in it, that I don't want to do. This book, incidentally, has another couple of great pages. It talks about someone, his name is Yaakov Robinson. I don't know if any of you have heard of Yaakov Robinson. I actually did a post about him. He was called the Radichkover. You have the Rogachover and the Radichkover. Radichkover, he was an Eloy of Eloyim, famous in Jerusalem. There's two tshuvot of Igros Moshe from Russia already to him. But he was a Meshuggah, a crazy man. As I once heard from one of the rabbis in my town, this older rabbi, Rav Herschel Cohen was his name, if anyone knows who I'm referring to. He once said that there's a fine line between an Eloy, a genius, and a Meshuggah. And that's, it's true. There is, and we can give examples. But he would go to the different yeshivas, and especially Merkaz HaRav, but the other yeshivas as well. When I wrote my post on him, Rav Elazar Meir Teitz and Professor Havlin contacted me that they remember him, Rabbi Teitz from Ponevezh and Havlin from Chevron. He was one of these guys, Eluyin, he'd go to talk to the Bachrim and there'd always be a big crowd around him. So in this book, he tells, and it's relevant because we spoke, remember last class, the letter to Lieberman from the anonymous friend. He says to him, Oy la Russia, woe to the wicked one and woe to his neighbor. And you, Lieberman, you're being with the conservatives, so you're a neighbor now of the wicked ones. So he tells a story. Well, before I get to the story, I'll tell you the previous story he tells, which I also mentioned in my post, that although he gives the name of the person who spoke to him about this, he'd go to Merkaz a lot. And once he gets up and he carries the Mishnah Torah and he carries it right into the bathroom. Whoever heard of carrying a sefer into the bathroom? So they asked him, what's going on? How could you bring the sefer in the bathroom? And you know what his reply was? The Rambam himself went to the bathroom. If the Rambam could go into the bathroom, then Kava Chomer, I could bring the sefer of the Rambam into the bathroom. And that's what he said. But the new story that he tells here on page 142 is Rav Yitzhak Arieli. Yitzhak Arieli is known as the Inayim LaMishpat. He was the Mashkiach Ruchani of the Merkaz Rav Yeshiva. He's one of these great Jerusalem Gaonim. you don't today in the Haredi world, his grandchildren are all Haredim, so you don't hear about his relationship to Merkaz. But he was, when the yeshiva was founded, there were four rebbes at Merkaz Rav. It was Rav Kook, Rav Harlap, the Nazir, and Rav Yitzhak Arieli, the Yanam Mishpat. So the story is as follows. He was involved with Merkaz to the 60s. Rav Arieli is the father-in-law, if you recall. Remember the famous video I showed you of Rav Kahana from the Mir who comes to Lubavitcher Rebbe? The only time the Lubavitcher Rebbe responded to his critics, that 20-minute long attack of the Rebbe on the people who are not fair to Chabad, that's the son-in-law of Rabbi Arieli, the Einayim HaMishpat. But he says, he sees Rabbi, his name was Yaakov Robinson, the Radichkever, he's cutting out Tosfos. He's cutting out a Tosfos. And he goes, he's holding on a Gemara. Gemara is open to a page, and he's cutting out this Tosfos with a scissors. So he comes up to him and says, what are you doing? After all, I mean, that's what the Christians did. They censored it. So what did he reply, the Radichkever? He says, I'm taking it out because what Tosfos says here is nonsense, and we're no v'yarta rami kirbecha. We have to get rid of that which is nonsensical and which is bad. So Rabbi Arieli thought for a second, then said, but wait a second. Okay, let's say you're right. But what did the Tosfos on the other side of the Gemara do wrong that you're cutting it out? He's getting cut out also. So what did the Radichkever, who he calls him HaBachur HaZakein, Bachur means one who is not married, he replied that this is Peshitta, because we already have a Pesach, Oyla Rasha, Oyla Shleino. If the one side of the Tosfos is bad and we have to get rid of it, Kavachur also, I mean, the neighbor, as it were, the other side. The Radichkever, by the way, there's two famous stories also of the Radichkever, I'll tell you. Radichkever himself wrote this. I have this, two of his svarim he wrote, or couldn't trace him. He says, one time after davening, someone came up to him and asked him why he's sitting in Vayvarach David. Vayvarach David, the general practice is to stand, but there were people in Lithuania in particular who sat. And someone told me when I wrote about this that there's still a show in Borough Park, or Flatbush, sorry, where they sit in Vayvarach David. Notice it's Vayvarach David, not Vayvarach David. Take a look, you'll see where the trope is. So what does the Richard Discover say? He told him, he said, I thought to myself, he says, Zeshani Yoshev Isha, here which I'm sitting, as the words, I'm dwelling without a wife. That doesn't bother him. Zeshani Yoshev B'li Parnasa, that which I'm sitting, I have no Parnasa. Zelo mafrielo, that doesn't bother him. Ma kein mafrielo, what does bother him is that I'm sitting in Vayvarach David. And finally, he was, the Radichkever was a, not a hypochondriac, I forgot the word. He thought everyone was out to get him. And he never made, and he never prepared any food that he himself didn't prepare. And once he comes screaming into the house of the Chazon Ish, with the taina, as it says, that some of the people of the yeshiva, presumably maybe Ponovej, right there, were trying to poison him. What should he do? So listen to the Chazon Ish, the genius Chazon Ish, he said to him. He says, what did they put in the tea first? Did they put the tea or the poison? And Rav Yankala thought for a minute, and then he says, first they put the tea, and then they put the poison. And what the Chazon Ish say? Hare poskim shetata gavar. He said, we poskim that if you have in halacha, first you have, let's say, hot at the bottom and cold at the top, or vice versa, from the standpoint of halacha, cooking and all that, we go by like the bottom. So if they put the tea in first, then the poison can't affect you. And that the Radichkever, he was made happy because of that. And then he could drink the tea. And one last thing. Many of you emailed me about Rabbi Ralbag. Let me show you a picture of Rabbi Ralbag. Here is Rabbi Ralbag from the Young Israel of Avenue K. In the Haredi world, they know who he is. Even if he went to MTA, incidentally, but then he went off to says Chevron. You have all the things, even an MA in psychology from Fordham. Look at that. Although I don't think he has a BA, so you get a the BTL maybe. So in the Haredi world, maybe they don't hold on as kashrus, but they know he's a big lamdan. As I mentioned, in the modern Orthodox world, they don't even know who he is. The typical modern Orthodox person, they just know you can't trust him, and half of them think he's like a conservative rabbi. I can't tell you the stories I've had with people. I once in the when we were doing the Kaplan business, I spoke to him like four times trying to arrange and other things, and I had the courage and the chutzpah. You decide. I actually said to him, you know, in the modern Orthodox world, I've seen, I said that they don't always trust your hashkacha. I was speaking, I said, don't always. It's more than that. And his reply was as follows, Bazeh HaLashon, in these words, got very upset, not at me, or maybe at me, I don't know. He said, those people go mixed swimming and they don't trust my hashkacha? So, but here is his sefer, one of his sefer, is sefer Pnei Aryeh, all about Eruvin. And you can read about, it's a whole big sefer about the Amsterdam Eruv, which goes back to the Chacham Tzvi and Halacha. It has Haskamas in the front of the Dayan of the Eid HaRedis, of Rabbi Hirschsprung, of the Tzitz Eliezer, et cetera, et cetera. So I'll end with this before I go on this business with the modern Orthodox and Rabbi Ralbag. It reminds me almost of, and it's Nogea today, the year we're in, the Shemitah. I can't tell you how many times people have said to me, modern Orthodox, not learned types, anything like that, they've said that you can't eat any food this year from Israel. Basically, they're all BDS. We have to boycott it. And I've seen signs in shuls not saying, don't eat this stuff. Now, when Rabbi Ralbag got all upset about the modern Orthodox, I could have said to him, well, it's not them. They don't know. They're just following what the rabbis say. So it's the same thing with the modern Orthodox about the Shemitah. They're just following what their rabbis tell them. And what's so stupid, I think, is that these are the people, you know, who type I'm talking about. They'll go to Israel. They'll immediately, they don't know Shemitah, not Shemitah. If they go to Israel tomorrow, they'll eat at any restaurant. If you tell them it's Heter Mechira, they won't even know what Heter Mechira is. In other words, these are not the people who are the Machmir types and everything, and yet they're being told by the so-called modern Orthodox rabbis they can't buy any products from Israel or anything without even explaining that there's such a concept also of Kedushas feast, certain things you can eat. But this stuff drives me crazy about people who are hardly, you know, the Machmirim, and they're going around telling everyone you can't eat anything from Israel, and they didn't even, but it's not their fault. They don't know any better. And Heter Mechira, they don't even know what Heter Mechira is. So that's the situation, I think, a lot also with the Rabbi Ralbag. They don't know, and they're just repeating stuff they've heard. And it bothers me because no one's ever been able to explain to me what the issues are. The one thing that one rabbi had the courage to tell me about a certain way of koshering, I actually asked Rabbi Ralbag, and he says he doesn't know why they're upset with him. He got ahead, Rabbi Elyashiv told him that in industrial plants, you can kosher this way as opposed to at home. So again, I'm not your rabbi. I'm just telling you that it's one of the strange things that I found. Let's pick up now. We're continuing with Reb Shaul Lieberman. And the last, we're going to see stuff which is very relevant even today. We started speaking about the ketubah. Why are we speaking about the ketubah? Because, as I said, Finkelstein comes to Lieberman and he says, we have to do something about the Aguna crisis. And as I said, the problem was that they were afraid that, well, it's not just a fear. Let me give you some statistics here to show what Lieberman was so concerned with. I'm holding... I have a book here, a dissertation. It's called Law and Legitimacy, An Intellectual History of Conservative Judaism, 1902 to 1973, by Sidney Schwartz from 1981. And if you look on page 324, he tells us as follows, that this is a little later in the 60s, but still, I'll show you that the same idea was going on even earlier, that... you had in the 1960s, half of all conservative rabbis, if a woman didn't get a get, what would they do? They would refer her to a reform colleague. And 30% of the conservative rabbis didn't even do that. They were prepared to do a wedding without the required get under certain circumstances. This goes back to this conservative idea that we can void the marriage. So, I'll read you a passage in a little bit that Finkelstein was very concerned about this, that the Committee on Law and Standards, or as far as Finkelstein was concerned, the Committee of Lack of Law and Standards, was going to completely uproot traditional Jewish law of marriage if you couldn't solve the Aguna problem. So he turned to Lieberman. And Lieberman came up with his ketubah. I'm going to read you in English here what the crucial part of it is. You can see this in Benjamin Steiner's he wrote a dissertation on the ketubah, but his article, I think it's American Jewish Archives, 1987, this is what's signed. As evidence, Lieberman wrote in Aramaic, but this is the English. As evidence of our desire to enable each other to live in accordance with the Jewish law of marriage throughout our lifetime, we, the bride and bridegroom, attach our signatures to this ketubah and hereby agree to recognize the Beth Din of the Rabbinical Assembly and the Jewish Theological Assembly of America. It was a joint Beth Din, or its duly appointed representatives, as having authority to counsel us in light of Jewish tradition, which requires husband and wife to give each other complete love and devotion. And then it goes on that if they don't give a get, if like the husband doesn't, we authorize the Beth Din to impose such terms of compensation as it may see fit for failure to respond to its summons or to carry out its decision. So the Beth Din has the authority to issue monetary award, and that would encourage the husband to give the get. And Steiner continues that this cause served the end that Finkelstein intended, because the Committee of Jewish Law and Standards therefore suspended its own aguna activism. And as Steiner says, competent authorities had triumphed over those who would vitiate the halachic tradition. Lieberman, I mean, Finkelstein felt that, as I said, you couldn't trust the rabbinical assembly rabbis. And Lieberman had good reason for feeling this. In Steiner, on page 56, quotes a letter from Rabbi Edward Tenenbaum. I don't know who he was, where he was rabbi, but he says as follows. And this is his response to Lieberman's ketubah and Finkelstein's effort of creating a halachic solution. Listen to this. For some time now, I have had a sneaking suspicion, which was confirmed today, and I certainly hope you will not think my words harsh. And this suspicion was that the faculty of our seminary is not a, quote, conservative faculty in the sense of the conservative movement. Tenenbaum is saying that the faculty at JTS is not conservative like we are. When I left Yeshiva University to come to the seminary, it was precisely because in all good conscience, I felt I could not live according to the laws of the Shulchan Aruch. I had expected, and rightly so, I don't think it was a mistake that conservative Judaism is and should be different from Orthodox Judaism. Then he says, but today we're told that the Shulchan Aruch is to be our guide. So here you see, Lieberman and Finkelstein are trying to argue that we need to follow the Shulchan Aruch. We have to create a halachically acceptable solution. And Rabbi Tenenbaum is saying, wait a second. If I wanted that, I would have remained over at YU. I came to the seminary, Dafka, because we don't need to be guided by the Shulchan Aruch. We can create our own halachic system. We can be modern day Pharisees. That was the slogan, basically. We can make takanot and do all, as Steiner says, like so many conservative rabbis, Tenenbaum attended JTS precisely to escape orthodoxy. Now the Lieberman cause threatened to re-anchor him to orthodox texts and institutions of authority. I'm holding another book here, another dissertation. Very fortunate, my University of Scranton, they buy all these, you can buy them too, but they're expensive, these doctoral dissertations that hardly anyone reads, but I like them, and they buy them for me, for the university library, and then you'd be amazed how often other universities order them, because you can't really find dissertations. This is by a woman, Regina Stein, JTS PhD, 1998, called The Boundaries of Gender, The Role of Gender Issues in Forming American Jewish Denominational Identity, 1913-1963. It's all about the Machitza, the point of the Aguna. The whole section, part three, is about the Aguna. On page 318, she quotes Ira Eisenstein. That's the son-in-law of Mordechai Kaplan, and he's one of the leaders of the Reconstructionist movement. He was president of the Rabbinical Assembly in 54, right when Lieberman's doing his ketubah. And he's also a member of the Committee of Jewish Law and Standards. And listen to what Eisenstein says, in opposition to Lieberman. So don't think that they accepted Lieberman. We are still operating under the orthodox assumption that the basic inequality of women must be preserved in the law. And he goes on and on that the problem with Lieberman's approach is that this is orthodoxy. You're accepting the fact that you need a get, and if the husband doesn't give a get, then the wife can't be remarried. And Eisenstein's attitude is, like we saw at Tenenbaum, we need to recreate halacha. And they came up with ways to do that, give the rabbis the authority to hafkas kiddushin, to uproot marriage. And finally, along these lines, on page 58, Steiner speaks about how another problem they had with the Lieberman Ketubah is it's only dealing with the aguna that we, when the husband refuses to give a wife, to give his wife a get. What about the other type of aguna, where the husband disappears? And what do you do about that? And the conservative rabbis were saying, no, we have to solve that as well. So obviously we see a problem here. What Lieberman had said when he wrote the Agudas Rabbonim in 10 years before that, in the 40s, that as long as the institution is committed to halakha, then I can work here. That's fine. The institution is, but the rabbis were not committed to traditional halakha. What was the response of the Agudas Rabbanim for all this? Well, they had a problem here because the Lieberman was, they still knew who he was, but here he's involved with this effort. And one thing, quite apart, as I mentioned last week, quite apart from halachic criticisms, which I'll get to in a second, the very idea that the conservative movement could come up with a solution to a problem, that's impossible. You can't give them any authority, even if it's halachically correct. In Apardes, in January of 55, he reports on the meeting of Agudas Rabbanim, in which a number of important Rabbanim speak out against the Ketubah and a conservative Beistin. But I think it's interesting, if you look at the article, you see, unlike when they attacked Epstein's proposal, and they had no problem attacking him by name, they don't mention Lieberman by name. They're still giving him the kavod of not mentioning him by name, and that still shows that they thought he was worthy of respect. We'll see that, for some of them at least, that does not last much longer. But the proposal itself was blasted. And both for the ideological reasons I said, namely conservative rabbis can't be involved in halachic matters, but also for halachic reasons. Norman Lamb, one of his very first articles, he was editor of Tradition Magazine, he was rabbi in Springfield, Massachusetts, it might be his first real article in Tradition, you have to check. He has an article with the problems about the Ketubah. Now, I don't mean what I'm going to say here to be at all disrespectful to Rabbi Lamb. You recall, if you were with me after he passed away, I spoke about him. There's letters of him in the book, the Igros Malchei Rabbana. I'm a great admirer of Dr. Lamb. But there was something just strange, that's the best way to put it, that after Lamb published his article, all the Orthodox spokesmen now started quoting Lamb's article as if it refutes Lieberman and refutes the conservative Ketubah, and that settles the issue. And Lieberman didn't respond to Lamb. But suffice it to say that Norman Lamb, he was a Talmud Chacham, no question about it, even during those younger years when he was a young rabbi in the 50s. But let's be real here. You can't compare Norman Lamb to Shaul Lieberman. Shaul Lieberman, Gon Shebegaonim. Norman Lamb was never regarded as a halachic or Talmudic authority. That doesn't mean he can't have good criticisms, but the idea that settles the matter. It's not like, and by the way, the Rav, they say that Lieberman was coordinating his idea with the Rav, and the Rav didn't object to it. But still, it's you're comparing apples and oranges here. If it's Ramosha Feinstein criticizing the Lieberman Ketubah, it's one thing. A newly minted rabbi, a pulpit rabbi in Springfield, Massachusetts, you're not dealing with in the same leagues here. Let's just make that clear. I once spoke to, not about this, I should have asked about this, but we know that Lieberman was one of the gedolim of Mechkar, of scholarship, but the other one I've already mentioned was Harry Wolfson. So in the Jewish Lamb in the 70s or the 60s, he writes an article in the Jewish Quarterly Review on medieval philosophy. And who decides to come in next issue and take apart the article piece by piece and attack him? None other than that other great gadol, Harry Wolfson. So I asked Lamb once, I said, how did you feel, a young scholar, when the greatest Jewish philosophy scholar in the world, Harry Wolfson, decides to take you apart piece by piece? So they have to come pick up the pieces after you. I would think that, you know, it's very embarrassing. We've had cases like this where big scholars do things like that. And what Lamb said to me, and what he probably got as being a student from the Rav, was that he said he thought it was a big honor. The fact that Wolfson decided to take him apart and thought that his article was worth responding to and take him apart, That's shows that he was worth something. It's like they would say about the Rav in the 50s, before the Rav mellowed, in the early 60s, when he would scream at people. And it was considered a kavod. If you were actually worthy of being screamed at by the Rav and told that your Sfara was amaratzos and nothing, that's actually a good thing, because it shows that you're worth engaging. If you just ignore you, then that's a different level. But what was Lamb's, and I'm not a authority, especially in these areas, so I can't judge. I just know how what Lieberman knew, but take my word for it, he had an answer to it, even if he chose not to respond, because he didn't want to get involved in polemics back and forth. But in Lamb's article, his major point is that the problem with the Lieberman ketubah, and we'll see in a minute that the RCA doesn't have this issue, is that no monetary amount is given. And since the monetary amount is award is vague, remember we said that the Beit Din will decide on the, they're signing something in which says that if the man doesn't give the get, then the Beit Din will decide what award to give. That's, since there's no specific monetary award, it puts it into the category of asmachta. Asmachta means when you sign an agreement or you make a deal to do something, but you don't really expect to have to measure up, because either you don't expect it's going to come to pass, or there's no, you can't really agree to, let's say, being charged $300 a day because you never expected, you didn't know. It's asmachta, it's vague. In order to have a binding contract, you must have complete knowledge, and thus have the that brings about consent. At least that was Lieberman's claim. I don't know how, it seems to be a good claim. I don't know what that was Lamb's claim. I don't know what Lieberman's response would be. The reason the Lieberman clause is not more specific is perhaps they were afraid that people would not sign a specific document like the sort I'm going to show you in a minute from the RCA. If you look in, there was a criticism of the Lieberman ketubah as well, from Levin and Kramer. These Leo Levin and Mayor Kramer. Kramer was at Pennsylvania Law School, and they have a whole article. I forget the wording of it. Recent adjustments to the tuba, something like that. And they give like five different reasons why it's no good and it won't work. And the most important one, I think, is number five. They say, court enforcement of a financial award made in order to compel the granting of a religious divorce would offend against the First and 14th Amendments and would be unconstitutional. And that was their big claim, that it's unconstitutional and never will be upheld, and therefore it's no good. Well, lo and behold, it turns out that they were incorrect. And I saw that we have with us the famous Nat Lewin, and Nat Lewin sent me a very long email about this, and by pointing out, incidentally, that when he was at YU, the Lieberman clause was unanimously condemned, but there was a case, Avitzor versus Avitzor, where he was involved with Nat Lewin, and lo and behold, as he writes to me, the court ruled that the clause was an arbitration provision requiring the parties to arbitrate before a rabbinical court, and that's what was constitutional. So it turns out that it was ruled to be constitutional. Furthermore, and this is what's really interesting, why did Nat Lewin, as he informs me, get involved with this case? Well, he was involved in cases affecting the Orthodox community, but he was specifically asked by none other than Rabbi Moshe Scherer, and head of the Agudas Yisrael of America, to write a brief defending the constitutionality of the Lieberman Clause. Can you believe that? They had their own interest, that they wanted this to be held constitutional, because there was a New York Get Law. There were other things, even if they didn't accept the Lieberman Ketubah, but they wanted it to be on record that this was constitutional. And as Nat points out, this had to be with the approval of the Mu'etzes Gedolei Torah. Moshe Scherer didn't have any authority to take positions like this without the approval of the Mu'etzes, or at least important members of it. From the standpoint of legality, the Lieberman ketubah was upheld. Incidentally, I should also say that Lamb, in his criticism of Lieberman, says that he has no objection to an amendment to the ketubah per se. He's not like we've seen certain figures in the Haredi world who are opposed to any changes at all, because it's not part of the tradition, the Mesorah. Lam says not at all. We can have adjustments. The problem is that Lieberman's adjustment doesn't deal with certain halachic matters, so it's problematic. Therefore, let's go back and make a better adjustment to the ketubah. In the end, when it comes to the RCA, they didn't go the ketubah route. They went the different route, which I'll show you. And Lam also points out a problem with, he thought, with the Kenyan, that the Lieberman ketubah doesn't solve. Again, I don't need to go into that, and I have no doubt that Lieberman had plenty of ways of explaining his position. I'll also add, before we go further, that the current version of the Lieberman clause, which was an adjustment by Rav Ben Zion Buxer, doesn't even specifically say that the Beit Din will issue a monetary award. It's all very vague. So I don't know if Lieberman stood behind this. It reads as follows. Hold on a second. Have it here. Yes, it says as follows. This is the current version of it, which I'm told that most conservative rabbis don't even use. They use the Tanai, the Tanai B'Kiddushin, this conditional marriage that then it can be voided. All it says in the Buxer version of it, that if either spouse shall fail to honor the demand of the other or to carry out the decision of the Beth Din, then the other spouse may invoke any and all remedies available in civil law and equity to enforce compliant with the Beth Din's decisions and this solemn obligation. But it doesn't say what Lieberman's ketubah says, that we authorize the Beth Din to impose such terms as compensation as it may see fit. It's even more vague theirs. Now, I want to eventually, at least in Orthodoxy, they came up with a solution. And I'll show you the solution in a second. The solution is the RCA prenup. And the RCA prenup, well, here it is. Let me show you the current version of it. The same basic idea. If you go to the RCA website, and you can find the different documents. And then if you pull up, here's the binding agreement, which is Rabbi Willig worked on it, and it has approval of many Gedolim. Here you can find on the page just the YU Rosh Yeshiva. Although you don't have Rabbi Bleich here, you have Rav Schechter, Rabbi Neuberger, Rabbi Rosenzweig, Rabbi Sachs, Rabbi Glickman, Rabbi Blau, Rabbi Harlap, Rabbi Feldman, Rabbi Tendler. Although it's Rabbi Tendler himself told me that he didn't think this was necessary. He says that according to the ketubah, the husband's obligated. So if, let's say, the husband and wife are living separately, if she's not divorced, the husband still has to support her according to the ketubah. So Rabbi Tendler didn't see why you needed this agreement, that you can just enforce the ketubah. So here it says, arbitration. Should a dispute arise between the parties, they submit to go before the Beth Din of America. And here's the important thing. The husband acknowledges the following. I obligate myself to support my wife to be according to the requirements of Jewish law governing husbands. So right now it says that I hereby now obligate myself in a matter that I cannot exempt myself with any claim of asmachta, that word I spoke about, or any other claim, to support my wife to be from the date that our domestic residence together shall cease for whatever reasons at the rate of $150 per day. Why $150 per day? Because that's calculated what you need to support yourself. Well, why not $3,000 a day? Well, because then you're getting into a problem of forced get. And that creates all sorts of halachic problems. But this is, you're compelling the husband to support the wife in what's not beyond normal and what she needs to survive, to live. And that used to be $100. Now it's $150. That will be enough for most people. If you're Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk, that's not going to be enough, obviously, $150 a day. So it's not a perfect solution. In that case, I don't know what the solution is. Maybe you have to get the goon squads. That was always a solution, but I'm saying it sarcastically. But it isn't a perfect solution. But for most people, $150 a day, every day, and it starts as soon as the Beis Din issues their ruling, it starts adding up. So if the man suddenly decides to give the get after a year, you add it up. You're talking tens of thousands of dollars. Now, mind you, they never collect. This is only a threat. You can, a whole book was published about this by Susan Aronoff and Rivka Hout. They never, you never collect the money. The whole point of this is to pressure the husband. And I'm told from people in the RCA that people who know about this, that there hasn't been one case of an aguna where the husband has signed it. That is, what I mean is, the husband's refused, and then when they come to terms with the fact that now they could be owed $20,000, $30,000, they agree to give the get, and the condition is that, and the deal is made, the woman waives her rights, because it would be hard, you'd have to go to court. The woman, they push this, the woman waives her rights to the money, and the husband gives the divorce, and that's what it's designed to accomplish. It's not designed for her to make money off it. It's designed to be a pressure tactic. And in terms of waiving it, you might think it's unfair, but that's what we do with the ketubah. When women get divorced, have you ever heard of a case? I've never heard of a case where a woman gets a ketubah. It's always waived. They come and they ask the person, do you waive it? I think the reason they have to waive it is because no one knows what the ketubah is worth. I mean, how many thousands of dollars? How many zuzik? You have to measure it with silver or something, but it's always waived. So this is a good solution. Let me just... and there's one more thing. If you go on the website of the RCA, I don't know if this is enforced. We have some RCA rabbis. They could tell us. This is 2016. Requiring the use of prenuptial agreements. Whereas our tradition celebrates married couples living together in peace and harmony and love and devotion all of their lives, and whereas the Torah recognizes that some marriages cannot be sustained and therefore provides procedures for the termination of those marriages, and whereas in some unfortunate instances a husband or wife refuses to cooperate with the appropriate instructions of the Beth Din regarding termination of the marriage, with a get, thereby preventing their spouse from building a new life, and whereas the prenuptial agreement of the Beth Din of America has obtained the approval of dozens of leading rabbinic authorities and remains, in the eyes of both activists and scholars, the single most effective solution to the aguna problem, and whereas even those members of the Rabbinical Council of America who follow rabbinic authorities who rule differently than those of the Beth Din of America, can use a different prenuptial agreement that meets the requirements of their rabbinic authorities, therefore, the Rabbinical Council of America declares that each of its members must utilize in any wedding at which he is the officiant, Masada Kiddushin, in addition to a ketubah, a rabbinically sanctioned prenuptial agreement, where available, that aids in our community's efforts to ensure the timely and unconditional issuance of a get. Is this true? Is this, it's saying that to be a member of the RCA, you must use, if not the RCA's prenuptial, another prenuptial. Do they enforce that? Is every RCA rabbi? Chabad rabbis are members of the RCA. I know a few Chabad rabbis.
Dr. Mark, as I just wrote, it's not enforced at all. The RCA, I can tell you as a member of the RCA, it's highly recommended, but they do not enforce it. Just the IRF enforces it.
Okay. So whenever you have a declaration, a requirement, which isn't enforced, that means that it's not a requirement.
So. It's because too many members of the RCA unfortunately opposed it, and they didn't, you know, they're going to start throwing out, these people. So it's not enforced, although most congregational rabbis, I think, do use it, but it's not enforced.
And you can make a claim of conscience. If my Rebbe doesn't accept it, are we going to say that we're not going to allow, let's say, a certain Haredi rabbi who follows his Haredi Rav who doesn't accept it? We're not going to allow them in the RCA? I could see how it creates problems of conscience. Now, the RCA came. It took decades to come to this decision, but it didn't need to be so long, really, because the answer was around all the time in this book. Tevuot Shemesh. Who is the Tevuot Shemesh? The Tevuot Shemesh, you'll recall from my classes, is, let's see, where's the Tevuot Shemesh here? I want to show you a picture of him. I'm going to have to pull it up here. Okay. There you go. Rav Sholom Messas, chief rabbi of Morocco, of Casablanca. And he he was involved in the 1950s. There was a whole Moroccan rabbinic conference to deal with this issue. They also were concerned in Morocco. And lo and behold, they came up with a solution. I have, hold on a second, the documents here, in addition to the Sefer. Oh, I don't have it here. But he tells the whole story. Oh, here it is. I have it. He writes as follows in his Tshuvot Shema Shema Gein, Evan Ezer, Volume 1, Number 11. He talks about how in 1984, he came to New York because the RCA invited him to be, they were having a big hotel, and the head of their RCA, Rabbi Klapperman, spoke to him and asked him, could they find a way to solve this problem of men who divorce their wives and don't want to divorce in accordance with Torah law, and they want to get a lot of money from the women. And he replied to them, well, it's not a problem. We already dealt with it. We made a takana, the Moetzet Rabbanut of Morocco, to require the husband before marriage to do a contract that did the same exact thing that the RCA does. And if you look at the tshuva that he writes here, it's in number 66, Tevuot Shemesh. He says as follows. It's almost identical to the RCA's proposal. I don't know if Rabbi Willig was aware of it when he was working on it. And what did they conclude? They concluded that this is in the 1950s, that they would require, where does it say here? I think it's 5,000 francs a day. 5,000 francs a day. I did the numbers. A franc in the 50s was like one quarter of a cent. And then, so it comes down to like with inflation, about $140 today. So it was the same exact proposal. So we have proposals. We have ways of dealing with this. Let's go on. The growing alienation of Lieberman and the Orthodox was clearly seen in an episode that I discuss in my Lieberman and the Orthodox booklet in 1957. Lieberman was given the award, the Rav Kook Prize. The municipality of Tel Aviv would award a Torah for Torah authors every year. It was called the Rav Kook Prize. And in 1955, Lieberman began publishing his magnum opus, Tosefta Kivshuta. We're going to get again, we'll deal with Tosefta Kivshuta. And it was for this work he was to be recognized. Who was on the committee? Obviously, Talmidei Chachamim and Orthodox Jews. Pinchas Churgin, he comes from America, well, from Europe, but then he's in America. He worked at Yeshiva University for many years, Yeshiva College, I should say. He had then left and became president of Bar-Ilan. Binyamin DeVries, he's a Torah scholar from the Netherlands, academic scholar as well. And Ezra Tzion Melamed, who's also a Torah quasi-academic scholar. And they decided that to give Lieberman this award, after all, it's a very important work, just have to give Shuto. They were hardly prepared for the controversy that would ensue. Even before the prize was officially announced, there was talk that it was going to go to Lieberman. There's a newspaper, you can see it now online at the Jewish National Library, has it online, She'arim. She'arim was the newspaper of Poalei Agudas Yisrael. Poalei Agudas Yisrael were the workers' party, socialist, quasi-socialist in Agudas Yisrael. They're always more moderate than Agudas Yisrael, and eventually they end up breaking with Agudas Yisrael, and they don't exist anymore as a party. Either the people remained in Agudas Yisrael or they merged with Mizrahi. But they have a kibbutz, Kibbutz Chavetz Chaim, and they have another kibbutz as well. But they had a newspaper, which was well-read. Chiyach Weinberg used to write for it. And they published an article under the heading, quote, "The Rav Kook Prize should not be given to one who is unworthy of it." And the article notes that this is an important prize, and it's named after a great gadol, Rav Kook. And they said that Torah Judaism doesn't make a separation between authors and their works. If someone writes a great work of Torah scholarship, but he himself in his personal life is not worthy of being regarded as one of the Torah sages, then his books must be regarded as similarly. And the article continues that since the Rav Kook Prize is specifically designed for Torah literature, it can't go to someone who's living a life in opposition to Rav Kook's ideology. And therefore, Rav Kook, who's opposed to conservative or non-Orthodox, how could you give it to someone who works with the non-Orthodox? Therefore, the article says to award it to someone, who would be such as Lieberman, obviously, is an insult to Rav Kook's memory. And the article says as follows, quote, "These circles," referring to the conservatives, "are no different than the Reform, and they have succeeded in ensnaring in their net a personality with great Torah knowledge. But this personality, namely Lieberman, disqualified himself by entering their orbit." And the article concludes, "We turn to those responsible for this prize. Don't humiliate the memory of the Gaon and Tzaddik for whom the prize is named. Do not assist sinners in giving the prize to a man who works in the orbit of Reform. At the same time that we in the land of Israel are battling the Reform." Together with Lieberman, they're supposed to give the prize to two people. That was the plan. Two great Torah scholars. The other one they're going to give it to is this individual, Rav Meshulam Roth. Meshulam Roth, he wrote Shelos and Tshuvos Kol Mevaser, a Gaon Shebegaonim. He's not as well known because he was a Zionist, and he lost out an important, I think it was the city of Chernivets, important rabbinic position in Europe. He was always sort of on the outs in the Haredi world, but everyone knew he was a Gaon Shebegaonim, or Meshulam Roth. If he was not a Zionist, they would have made him like the Gadol Hador. If you look at a Sefer, you see what I'm talking about here. And Rav Meshulam Roth was viewed as a moderate. After all, he's a Zionist, so by definition, you sort of have to be more moderate because you have a more wider Kol Yisrael type of perspective. And yet he comes out, surprises everyone by announcing he refuses, will not accept the award together with Lieberman. And this isn't some stereotypical Eda Haredi type of extremist. He's a member of the chief rabbinate. The chief rabbinate, so many of their members were close friends with Lieberman. At this time, it's Rav Unterman, Rav Zev, and many others. He's a member of Mizrahi. But he doesn't come to Eretz Yisrael until 44. And thus, he never knew Lieberman. He never had a personal connection. Like all these other big rabbis, they knew Lieberman from the 30s. Well, because of Rav Meshulam's refusal to receive the award together with Lieberman, what are you going to do? The presentation ceremony had to be postponed. They had to figure out, what are they going to do? In Hatzofeh, which is the newspaper of the Mizrahi, the National Religious Party, he explained that it was forbidden. Rav Meshulam Roth's letter says, "It is forbidden for me to receive an award together with a rabbi, quote, of a Reform community." And Rav Meshulam cites Avos Rabbi Nassim. Chapter 9, Halacha 4 says, "Don't associate with the wicked, even for the study of Torah." And he's saying to Lieberman, you violated this. I'm not clear whether he's saying that Lieberman's problem is that he associates with the wicked, or Lieberman, he's saying that Lieberman is the wicked, and therefore he can't associate with him even for involvement of Torah. It's not clear what he's referring to, but these are obviously very, either way you look at it, they're very strong words. Now, and he calls Lieberman a Reform rabbi. So I think the pshat here is that it's Lieberman who's the wicked. He's saying, don't associate with the wicked, even for Torah purposes. Well, in response to this accusation that Lieberman's a Reform rabbi, Chaim Leshem, who was a scholar and a bit of an author, he wrote to Rabbi Meshulam and declares, quote, "We all know that Professor Lieberman is among the Gedolei Torah of our day, who's a religious Jew, and he's a Yerushalayim. He's not a rabbi in a Reform community." And Leshem then attempts to prove that it's permitted for Lieberman to teach Torah at the seminary. And he relies heavily, there's a tshuva, responsum of Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi, who writes from Turkey, that it's not only permissible, but a great mitzvah to teach Torah to the Karaites. Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi, the author of the Mizrahi on the Torah, the commentary on Rashi, he was in the 1600s, I believe. Hold on, let me just check exactly what his dates are. He dies 1526. The Mizrahi was asked, can you teach Torah to Karaites? And the Mizrahi says that you can, and it's even a mitzvah, and you can bring them back to Torah Judaism. So Leshem says, if if the Mizrahi says that you can teach, not only can you teach Torah to Karaites, and it's a mitzvah to teach Torah to Karaites, how much more so can you teach in the conservative JTS that you can bring them back to Torah Judaism? But Rav Meshulam doesn't accept this. In response to Leshem's points, Rav Meshulam writes a formal responsum on the topic. You can see it in the Kol Mevaser, Volume 2, Number 17. I'm holding it in front of me now, and here's the question. Are you permitted to be a teacher in a Beit Midrash Rabbanim Reforming? Can you be a teacher in a Reform seminary? For Rav Meshulam Roth, Conservative Reform, they're all the same. They're all... And he begins by quoting the Gemara in Makos, and someone asked us about this last week. The Gemara says you can't teach an unworthy disciple. You're not allowed to teach a student who's unworthy. And this is codified in the Mishnah Torah, Hilchos Talmud Torah, Perek Daled. And according to Rav Meshulam, this applies even if you're teaching him Torah in order to influence him to be observant. He says... Again, he quotes Avos Rabbi Nassan, and he quotes, it says in Avos Rabbi Nassan, Al tiskaber l'rasha v'afilu v'torah. Don't come close, don't connect yourself to a Rasha, even for Torah. What does that mean, even for Torah? So the Gra there says, afilu l'karvu v'torah, even to bring him close to Torah. And he expands on this and brings another proof that... even if you teach Torah to a Talmud, Shaino Hagun, who's not proper, you think you're doing it, you're doing a mitzvah, you're reading it close to Torah, mitzvah haba b'averihi. Rav Meshulam says this is a mitzvah that comes from an aver. And then he also quotes the pasuk, Oy l'rasha o l'shchaino. So maybe saying that, again, I'm not clear, who's the Russia here? Is it the conservatives and it's Lieberman, or Lieberman's the Russia? Who's joining there, but in this case, it would be anyone who wants to join with them. You can't. And then he says, in particular, when you're dealing with someone whose position is l'hamid rabbanim reforming, l'tek ha'sicha rabbanos, when you talk about someone whose job is, you're not just teaching, your job is to create reform rabbis and give them smicha. Not only is there an issur, he says, of a tamo sheno hagun, that you're teaching a student who's not appropriate, there's another issur. That you're creating a michshol, a stumbling block for the many. And he quotes what it says in the Shulchan Aruch, Kol ha'mami dayan sheino hagun ke'ilu nateh asher b'Yisrael. If anyone sets up a dayan in Israel who's not worthy, it's as if you planted like an idolatrous tree. I see it's already 9:30. So we'll continue more next class with Rav Meshulam says, but just think of the implications of this, Rav Meshulam saying. Does this mean you can't teach in a Kiruv program? Because the students, now you're going to say they're Tinok Shanishba. Maybe this is Lieberman's whole point was, as he said in the Sayyidah Tugas Rabbanim, that these are, to me, these are people there. They don't know any better. He thinks they're Tinok Shanishba. So it's, and he never raises the issue of Tinok Shanishba. So can you stop someone, you have a program and you bring in these irreligious people, you're trying to turn them around. At this moment in time, some are Tinok Shanishba, but some are atheists, and some are actual deniers and are not Tinok Shanishba. Today, we don't say that that's a problem. We would say, on the contrary, if you can bring them back, all the more so. But Rav Meshulam says that even teaching them is a problem. So we will pick up next class with continue with Rav Meshulam, and then we'll hear what Rav Gifter, Rav Mordechai Gifter, enters the scene. Rav Mordechai Gifter, who comes off as such a kanai, not just in his whole career, in this attack on Lieberman as well, just to whet your appetite, what I'm gonna show you next class is as follows. Here it is. We'll talk about how Rav Gifter was before he became so extreme. I'll talk about his correspondence with none other than Louis Ginsberg. Here's one of the letters. I've never published these because I'm afraid the family is going to get very annoyed with me, although I quote selections of it. So here, this is from the young Rabbi Mordechai Gifter when he's in Waterbury, and he engages in long Torah correspondence with Kavod HaRav Rav Levi Ginsberg Shlita, He doesn't call him Harav HaGaon or anything like that. He understands he shouldn't be given those titles. But wait till you see how Rav Gifter changed. And then following that, I think we will move into... we'll have to move into Tosefta Kipshuta. Maybe we'll get to Tosefta Kipshuta after we see how this whole controversy ended in Tel Aviv. Move into some of, and into the 1970s even, what happens there. So let me take the questions. We did a lot today. Let's see. Yeah, Rabbi Kelman says she wasn't called Rabbanit during her lifetime. They didn't use the term Rabbanit, even as Rebbet. Well, she was called Rabbanit there as Rebbetzin. But I don't think, I don't recall from the 1980s people being called, or she died in the 70s, being called Rabbanit then. Maybe in Israel they were, though. So then it would make sense to call her Rabbanit. Rabbi Hartman says that an Eloi is... Here, this was called from the Rav, then Eloi was called a Chatzi Eloi for this very reason about Eloi and Meshuggah. That's interesting. Thank you. Ramosha says that it's quoted by Rabbi Shurkin in his book, Megad Givot Olam, that we've always had trouble with Eloyim because Eloyim, they're trouble because there's, you don't know. They leave it at that. Paranoid, that's the word. Yes, paranoid. The Radishkever was paranoid, and Rabbi Yellen says it's great Purim Torah. Okay. And someone who knew Lieberman personally, not just knew Lieberman, drove him to the airport the last time that he left America. He died on that plane when he left America. He privately emails me, privately texts me right now, that Lieberman's personality included an impish component. And indeed it did. There's many stories. And the person who texted me this told me a story about that as well. If I recall correctly, Rav Adam Minsky, Rabbi Kelman says, gave a Torah in Motion shiur last year and explained how it took 40 years for Orthodoxy to allow grape juice for Kiddush because the conservative movement had allowed it during Prohibition. That was Louis Ginsburg, his famous tshuva. This is a natural thing, though, a bat mitzvah. If the non-Orthodox are doing it, and according to Rabbi Chaya of Weinberg, it's not just politics. He quotes, there's a whole concept. We think of Chukos HaGoyim, there's an idea of Chukos HaPikorsim also. He cites a proof from the Gemara about this. So there is a concept that if the Apikorsim are doing it, that we shouldn't do it. So there's even, you can make a halachic argument that you have to give it some time. But that's indeed the case. And Rabbi Kelman says, I can't recall where, but I recall reading Dr. Lamb writing somewhere to the effect that early in his rabbinate, he would lambast the conservative movement, but later realized it did not increase the Yirat Shamayim of even one person, but surely did turn off some. In his later years, he would attack the Agudas Rabbanim for putting those ads in, which are directed to the non-Orthodox Jews, telling them basically, don't go to synagogue on Rosh Hashanah and Kippur. And he said, what value is that? Rabbi Kelman says, in practice, the prenup works even for the very wealthy. They don't like to pay any money, even if they can afford it. It's not. Okay. No one likes to pay money, but understand.
There's also a psychological thing if you sign it already. That's what the people in the R said. Like you had mentioned right afterwards, that they'll tell you there's not one case of a prenup and then going to, even if they're very wealthy, somehow it seems to work, even if they could afford easily the $150 a day. Which okay. is good. I mean, you know, okay, whatever.
If you say so. We know that when it comes, certain times people are affected by money strangely. It's, I'll give you a story. It's told by, I think it's Ramashulam Igra gave this example. He was a Rav in Pressburg before the Chasam Sofer. I tell this story when we go to Pressburg. So just so you know, be ready, God willing, we're returning back to Europe this summer. If you haven't been with me to Central Europe, you're cordially invited. It's something to behold. But he raised a question. He said, why is it that, let's say you bring your chicken to the rabbi. It could be expensive, whatever. Even you have a problem, chomich over Pesach, you lose a lot of money. The rabbi paskins, you have to throw it out. You're happy, you'll throw it out. The Rav said, you're not happy. Let's say, but you accepted. The Rav said it, you do it. You feel you're doing your Torah duty. On the other hand, if you come and you have a case that didn't Torah with someone, even if it's for a small amount of money, and the Rav rules against you, you'll go out, you'll be cursing the rabbi, how do you rule against you? Why is it? In the first case, Yeah, no problem. It's even more money, but you accept the din. But in this case, and Rav Meshulam says, because it's not the money, that's not the issue. And the issue here is that the other guy got one. It's not the money. It's that you lost and they ruled against you. So it could be that these considerations come into play. Justin says, Israeli Mizrahi Ketubot render the money in contemporary Shkalim. I don't know stories of payout. I'd like to know what it is, because one of the reasons given why they don't talk about it, not only this, in this here, I put it in my book, Blake. But this Susan Aronoff and Riff Powder were very involved in the Igun issue, and they record how they went to all these rabbis. They mentioned my name, a number of them, and they asked them, what's a ketubah worth? And no one could give an exact figure. Because how do you figure out, what's a zuz and how much silver? So I'd be curious to know what they did there. David Eisen says, the compensation and mutual respect agreement penned by Dr. Rachel Levmore with the consultation of Zalman Nechema Goldberg and commonly used in Israel and endorsed by the Tzohar rabbis is the greater of 50% of the spouse's monthly income or $1,500 a month. Well, $150 a day is more than $1,500 a month. But you could say in Israel, it's cost of living is not as much. But you say the greater of 50%. So what's that saying is that if I'm making $3 million a year, that 50%. Okay, that's an interesting. So that should be fair. After all, if you're married, you should get half of it. But I think some people would argue that the husband's making the money. Especially if they have a more, patriarchal look at it. The husband's making the money, and therefore, if you're requiring 50% of it, that then becomes a forced get because it's not enough. The woman doesn't need $1 million a year to live on. But for more modern perspective, if he's making that much money because maybe she helped him go to school, et cetera, I don't know. It's a good point. But that hasn't been accepted by many outside the group you said. Justin says, the Chabad rabbi who was Masader at my daughter's wedding used the RCA. Very interesting, right? Because there are no, in the list of the rabbis who endorse it, no Chabad rabbis are listed, but you have Rav Asher Weiss and lots of rabbanim. Someone privately texts me, I know of a case where a prenup was signed and it took 5 years for the get to be given. The case is very public. I don't know how often such a long dispute happens. In Susan Aronoff's book, she gives examples. It could go on for a couple of years, so maybe you'll say that's an aguna, but during that period. But in the end, they always give it, and generally, at least the way she describes it, she's not so crazy about it. She thinks it doesn't solve all the problems, but the way she describes it is basically as soon as the husband realizes he's on the hook. Most of them don't realize. They sign a document, they don't pay attention, they don't realize it. That usually solves the problem. And Mike asks, did Shaul Lieberman make any attempt to dissuade people from driving on Shabbos? He doesn't seem like someone engaging in Kira from what I've learned. He was just engaged in teaching as pure academic. He does not. He was not that, everyone knew his opinions on this, but he wasn't, Dov Zlotnik, his student, will see that he was engaged in Kiruv of a sort at the seminary. Lieberman wasn't. And the truth is, I don't mean this to be a negative thing about Lieberman, but this just was his personality. He didn't have much of a relationship with many of the students. He had a relationship with the Chachamim. And he wanted the people who were just going into the rabbin into his career, and he didn't think they were serious about learning. He sometimes was contemptuous of them. Just like the Rav could be contemptuous of people who were not serious in learning and just wanted to be in it for a career or things like that. So there were many pulpit rabbis who did not look to Lieberman and Lieberman himself. He was a scholar. He wasn't one just to sit around. If he was a friend of yours, he would shoot the breeze. But he wasn't a Heschel. He wasn't like that sort of person. He was a Rosh Hashiva sort of type of London. His mind was in learning day and night. Day and night it was learning. Rabbi David Wolpe of Los Angeles, who listens to the classes, he told me the following story. He sent it to me, that which he heard from Halivni. Halivni and Lieberman's offices were right next to each other, and they had like a contest. They would keep the lights on, and no one wanted to be the first one to turn the lights off. So they would the lights would stay on to 1, 2 in the morning because no one wanted to be the first to one. But people like that, it's Torah learning above all. It's not, he didn't see himself as that in that role. Baruch says, Chatzi Iloy is a lesser Iloy. Not every Iloy is a Chatzi Iloy. No, not every Iloy is. Sprint says, wondering how long it took to give a get, given the prenup at the longest end. I don't know, but we just heard someone 5 years. Bill says, the story goes, Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer's parents complained to the Netziv that his son was called by the Netziv a half a gon, while the Netziv called Revuven Bengis a whole gon. The Netziv answered that your son is half a gon and half normal. And I'll end with this. So we, three semesters ago, I cited one of the rabbis who said about a certain gadol. Well, I know it was actually Rabbi Snow, if I recall, in his video. Go on YouTube, plug in Rabbi Moshe Snow. It's a great video about Rav Moshe Feinstein. And he doesn't speak about Rav Moshe's learning and all that because he says, who am I to talk about that? But he actually would drive Rav Moshe around. He had a car and he speaks about Rav Moshe, the person, the individual. But he says, and he's speaking about not just Rav Moshe, he's speaking about his children, he says, and they're normal. And it's like for an outsider outside our world, what is that? What do you mean to say? That's a compliment? You say they're normal? But we all know that we know of many Tamei Chachamim, including great Tamei Chachamim, that are not normal in quotes. In other words, you can't talk to them. You can't schmooze with them. You can't relate to them. They're just in a different world. So when you say about someone like a Rav Moshe Feinstein or David Feinstein, who were, you know, enormous Lamdonim and Gaonim and leaders of Klal Yisrael, that they're normal, it means that despite their greatness, they could still relate to regular people. And we in our world understand that that's a compliment. You say he's normal because you hear it all the time. They say about this, oh, he's an unbelievable Talmid Chacham. He's normal. But to be a Rav, you need to be able to relate to people. It's not just in the head. It also has to be elsewhere. Thank you all. And Rabbi Allen says Rabbi Snow was his basketball coach at MTJ. If you listen to the video, watch the video, you'll hear about that basketball championship. We had certain Kanaim who thought it was a Shanda that MTJ are playing with these so-called Orthodox schools, the other high schools. And again, they went to Rav Moshe and Rav Moshe gave, I guess you'd say, a normal answer. You know, it's okay for high school kids to go play basketball. And they arranged it in a way that even for the MTJ kids, that it was okay to play basketball against Flatbush and the rest of those places. Remember, in those days, they could have cheerleaders also at those schools. So I highly encourage everyone. The ones not normal are probably on the spectrum. It is true that we know that certain of these geniuses, just if you hear about the way they're described today, we would say we might use those expressions. Okay, thank you all.
But like I was saying, they didn't have the band contest. Rav Moshe wouldn't have allowed that. That was going too far. By the way, I was looking now for the last few minutes. I couldn't find it because they changed their website. And I don't remember his name, but the last director of Orot, you know, Orot College from Yehuda Felix started, wrote a phenomenal article. I'm sure you're familiar with it, about learning Torah from a non-religious person, non-religious, you know, so like a 40-page article in Hebrew. It's really phenomenal. It was on the old Orot, Michlala Orot website. It was written by, I can't remember his name. I once gave a whole sheer, like I read, it's a phenomenal article going through all the shitot about learning to, basically the conflict, Rav Meir and Acher on the one hand, you learn and you know, you take the sweet.
Well, I discussed that in the Kuntras also. By the way, let me just end one more thing, Barak. No, there were no cheerleaders at the basketball championship game. This was like a tournament sort of thing that they would not bring in when they played against then. But these schools did have cheerleaders, these other, yeshiva high schools in those days. They did. And by the way, the girls, they're just very modest. I showed pictures a few semesters ago, long skirts, long sleeves, the whole bit. But the idea for yeshiva, like MTJ, to say we're even going to have the opponent's attitude was that, first of all, it's a waste of time, Bittul Torah, but we're a yeshiva. It's like Rabbi Teitz told me when I wanted to know why we couldn't go to the Soviet Jewry rallies. And no, sorry, not Soviet Jewry, Israeli Day Parade. He says as follows. He said, we're a yeshiva. We don't need to be with those other Talmud Torahs and those other, what he meant, lesser schools like Frisch and the rest of them. He goes, we're a yeshiva. We don't go to parades. So...
I can testify that I was on the best. I was captain of the team. We never had cheerleaders at the games. That went too far. Yeah. But we played Yeshiva Flatbush and SRH and a whole bunch of others. And Ramosha said it was fine. Sometimes the other yeshivas said no, but Ramosha said it was fine.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Well.
Very nice. Okay. Cool. Okay. Very good. Thank you very much. Look forward to next week. Tomorrow morning, 11 a.m. Eastern time, 5 p.m. in Israel. Rachel Danziger-Sharansky's, shir will be Eastern time Wednesday. Rev Carmel shir will be at 2:15 as opposed to 1:15. So it'll be 8:15 in Israel. And Shuli Mishkin shir will be at 1 p.m. instead of 12 p.m. Eastern. So again, it'll correspond to 7 p.m. in Israel, just to sort of make note of those that will send out an email. Okay. We look forward to learning with everybody this week's Parsha shir. Once we're on the topic, Rabbi Yitzchak at Shalom, Rabbi Yellen, of course, a neighbor of yours. I don't know if he's Mamish, a neighbor of yours, but I know he's from you're in the LA time zone.
He also teaches my grandson at Yula High School.
Oh, okay. There you go. I figured you'd be connected with him. Yeah. Okay. Very nice. Thank you. And okay. And all the regular shiurim this week, we look forward to learning with you. And everybody have a wonderful night and all good things. And we should come together for learning Torah and all good occasions. Thank you very much. Good night, everybody.
Laila Tov.
Laila Tov. Laila Tov.